KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, this is The Treatment.
Welcome to The Treatment, which you can also hear at KCRW.com. I'm thrilled to have Alan Alda sitting across from me. I think of him as being one of the great talkers in American television, theater, and film. He's able to take characters who express themselves verbally and find all the flaws in those characters. And he also happens to be a really interesting man who, in terms of the way he works with women. Directed Meryl Streep in The Seduction of Joe Tynan.
I didn't direct that.
You wrote that.
I wrote it. Yeah.
But you directed Michelle Pfeiffer in Sweet Liberty.
Yes, I did.
Unless you want to correct me about something else.
No. I don't like to take credit for things I didn't do.
And one of my favorite performances, two of all time, were given by Alan Alda, the one in the Mephisto Waltz.
Oh, really? You like that?
I love that movie.
I hate that movie.
What do you hate about that movie?
You know what I hate about it? I was just beginning to get work as an actor, and I was very highfalutin. I only wanted to be in things that had meaning. You know, so my agent called and said, read The Exorcist. They might want to audition you for it.
And for which part do you remember?
I don't know. One of the big parts, one of the leading parts. Okay. I don't know. Maybe the priest. I don't know what it was. So I read the book and I said, this is a piece of trash. I'm not going to do this. So I turned down the chance to be in The Exorcist. And 2 years later, I wasn't getting any work. So I was in the Mephisto Waltz, which was worse than The Exorcist.
Well, I've been refuted by Alan Alda. It's early in the show, and I'm already being told I'm wrong with.
But no, you're not wrong. You're absolutely right to like what you like. That's really important. I don't like it when my friends want my opinion about what they might like. I like some movies that you probably don't like.
We can talk about that, too. But another of my favorite performances, I hope you like this one, is your performance as Carol Chessman in Kill Me If You
that
Can.
That I did like, yeah.
A terrific turn. And mm-hmm. And I think really sort of capsulized that power you have with words and the way he used words as kind of a punishment. The way
he was an interesting guy, wasn't he? He was on death row for rape and kidnap. And he claims he didn't do it. But he seems to have been some kind of genius or near genius and kept himself alive for 11 years on death row.
Basically the architect of his own defense.
Yeah, yeah. He became a student of the law, and I think he was a jailhouse lawyer for other inmates, but mainly kept the execution off for about 11 years, and then they finally killed him.
Your new play, which you've written, is Radiance on Marie Curie, which is playing at the Geffen Playhouse. I was asking before we started, I mean, given that the subtitle is A Passion of Marie Curie, mm-hmm. Where does that come from for you?
Passion or?
Yes. All of those things.
I have a lot of passion. But nobody had as much passion as Marie Curie, both for science, because she kept at what she was exploring until she really overturned what were then basic concepts.
The science
physics
became a kind of a philosophical pursuit for her.
Well, she wanted to discover what nature really was, and the notion of how the world was made, what matter was very different then. Before her discoveries,
she seems like it's rolling back to that kind of point now.
Yeah, right.
People denying science.
Well, that's true. That's true. But scientists didn't understand it at the time. They didn't understand that an atom could give off radiation. She gave us the word radiation. She didn't discover radiation. Another scientist did, but she started to measure it and then began to realize that other substances besides uranium were giving off this radiation. And she's the one who said, this is a property of the atom itself. The atom is giving off something, and it's changing. Well, that was thought to be alchemy at the time. An element was an element. An atom was an atom. It didn't change. You couldn't get it down to smaller pieces, and it was that way forever. So she was passionate. She had to be really passionate to keep at those studies until she came up with the answers, because she was really working in the dark. But she was passionate about her life, too, about the people she loved. And that makes a really good play for the stage, because she had everything against her in science, the difficulty of the science itself. that she was a woman. When she got, when she and her husband Pierre Curie got the first, they were shared a Nobel Prize with Henri Becquerel. They didn't want to give her the prize, and she had done most of the work, and she had actually discovered these other elements. So Pierre talked them into letting them share the prize, but what he couldn't talk them into was letting her get up on stage and accept it. She had to sit in the audience on her first Nobel Prize. Is that amazing?
That's amazing.
And that was because she was a woman. And 8 years later, she got another Nobel Prize, the first person to ever get two Nobel Prizes, and one of the, I think one of only two to get them in two different fields.
Fields, yeah.
He died, Pierre died, and she was depressed. And
eventually she did too, for radiation poisoning.
Yeah, well, she eventually died of radiation poisoning because they didn't really understand how dangerous it was. And he might have died partially from radiation poisoning. He was run over in the street by
my understanding was he'd been sort of like declining for years.
Oh, yeah, yeah. He was in pain all night. He would moan from the pain all night.
Well, I should say it's the treatment, my guess, who's keeping me from being inert is Alan Alda. We're talking about his new play as a writer, Radiance, the Passion of Marie Curie. But you were saying about...
Well, she was passionate about her love for Pierre because he was one of the few men alive who had the capability to be rooting for her as a scientist. So then Pierre dies. And she goes into a deep depression. She actually became a little suicidal. And I think what brought her out was falling in love with Paul Langevin, who was another genius. And he had been a student of Pierre's and was a friend of both of them. And her love with him was a passionate one, just like it had been with Pierre. But unfortunately, he was married to somebody who really didn't like it that they were having an affair. You know,
one of those rare French women who didn't like
it. Actually, it was rare because it was expected for a man to have a mistress, but it wasn't expected that the mistress would be on an equal footing socially with the wife. And this here was a renowned scientist, which humiliated the wife. So the social norms were very different then in Paris from what they are now. And so this woman threatened Marie's life. She threatened to kill her. This is an extremely interesting story, isn't it?
Oh, my God, it's great.
Yeah. So it makes a great play. So I've been working on this play for 4 years, and now it's opening at the Geffen.
It's The Treatment. My extremely passionate guest is Alan Alda, discussing a number of things, among which are his play Radiance, The Passion of Marie Curie. But I do find it fascinating that, as an actor, you have this gift, I think, for taking verbiage and giving it a real character locus. Mm. And I wonder where that came from for you. It was by virtue of being on stage where you had to sort of claim a place for a character by understanding the words? Because I think it's unusual for somebody to become that big a success in TV and film with that kind of... I can't think of many other people in the last 30 years who have really done it, who made the words mean so much.
I did start on the stage, and the stage is all about words, and I wanted to be a writer when I was 8 years old. It wasn't until later in life, when I was 9, I wanted to be an actor, and I always loved words and wanted to learn how to put them together so that they would do something to the brain of the reader or the listener. I didn't always put it in those terms when I was a kid, but that's what I was trying to do. I would sit when I was 15. I remember my father was in Guys and Dolls, getting ready to open it on Broadway, and they were trying it out of town in Philadelphia. And I'd get on the train to go down and visit him, and I had index cards with me, and I would write down what I heard people saying because I wanted to learn how people spoke. What were the characteristics of speech, real speech? And it was funny. It was later, about a year or two later, I began to realize that what's her name? A rose is a rose, you know.
Gertrude Stein.
Gertrude Stein. I think she had done a similar thing because her repetitive patterns, that's the way people speak. They talk in kind of like a rolling wheel. It takes a revolution, comes back, they say almost the same thing, and then they add something to it. And I was trying to learn from an early age how people spoke so that when I would write dialogue, it wouldn't sound like it was written. It would sound it would get into your brain the way spoken speech would get into your brain. At least that was my hope.
The thing that I just find fascinating about you as an actor, you've often played characters who have an excitement about words and expressing themselves. And that somehow must come from you, because the thing that links a lot of these people.
It had something to do with the rest of my body. I look better in a suit than I do in a loincloth. So that means I play people who speak rather than hit people.
But I still find that that's a really fascinating thing about you. Just that, I mean, just talking about Carol Chessman or Joe Tynan, or even you got to, at a certain point, you played nothing but centers between the West Wing and the Aviator.
I play people who talk. You're right.
Yes.
What am I going to say? Stick them up?
Those are words, too. But just the way some of these characters can turn from being charming to bullying in the same sentence, and that, to me, is just a really interesting thing. And I just wonder if it even comes from growing up watching your dad on the stage.
Well,
being around
I did.
The
you
stage.
Know, I did. I watched my – interesting, though. I watched my father in burlesque when I was two and a half years old until I was about three or four, something like that. And I was watching strippers and burlesque comics and chorus girls and straight men, singers. And I think I got a really good fusion of talk and movement. Certainly the strippers gave you a great sense of movement. And I developed a lifelong interest there. But the comics used words and a lot of puns and a lot of... The jokes were very simple and simple-minded, but the joke wasn't always just the word. The joke was the thought process under the word where you heard the collision of two subterranean thought processes. That's a little complicated, but it was often about what they were really thinking rather than what they were saying.
So they're offering a kind of subtext in the way that they spoke.
In a way, even though it was very routinized and formulaic. And today it wouldn't be funny to us. But I was hearing that happen, and I also saw the physical humor. You take a thought and you don't express it in words at all, but it comes out through the body. And that's really, that can be a revelation to see people who can really do that.
But so much of that is about this thing we're talking about subtext and things that even though there are verbal exchanges, those things you're talking about that go unsaid and the way that you use those words to sort of get what you want without saying what you want.
Yeah, that's the most interesting part about dramatic writing to me. If, like in the Marie Curie play in Radiance, if I'm sitting down to rewrite a scene or to throw it out and write a new scene, which I do whenever the actors are in rehearsal, you start to see what's possible and what the actors can come up with, and you think I think I can make a better scene here. What's always interesting to me is I'll often start off at the level of the words, of what they're saying to each other, but it's not until I get under the words and find out what they really are thinking when they say those words, which could be something very different from what they're saying, that's when it gets to be a scene. That's when it gets to be playable and interesting to watch, because you're figuring out what they really mean and how they're maneuvering one another, using the words like chess pieces, but really underneath, feeling things, meaning things, moving toward things that they don't express.
We'll take a break. My guest is extremely articulate, Alan Alda. His new play as playwright, of course, is Radiance, The Passion of Marie Curie. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us.
You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica.
Want more of The Treatment? Join us on Facebook and be part of the conversation. Search for The Treatment and click like.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment. It's Radiant here, or at least it is with Alan Alda, my guest. His play, new play at the Geffen Playhouse, is Radiance, The Passion of Marie Curie. You can also hear the show at kcrw.com. But you were talking about writing and writing subtext. And subtext is so different in movies. And often so much subtext in movies is sort of created by silence. And it's kind of a luxury you almost don't have as much in the theater. If people aren't moving, they almost have to talk.
Very often in the theater, though, it's the space between the words where the emotional impact occurs, I think. And I don't just mean pauses. I mean just that hair's breadth of time when you absorb what I'm saying to you before you come back at me. That's where the relatedness of the character shows up. It's where what we mean to each other shows up, that we don't take each other for granted. We're not inconsequential to one another. You're either an obstacle to me or you're helping me get what I want. So those spaces between the words are where the unconscious rises to the surface a lot.
Yeah, but I just feel like silence is a very different thing on the stage.
Yeah. Well, sure. Well, you can show things on film. You can do the insert. I always hate inserts, and I always try to avoid inserts.
Tell the audience what an insert is.
An insert is that two people are talking, but then one of them puts something in his pocket, say, and you cut to a tight shot of it going in his pocket, or you cut to a tight shot of it, of the watch going down on the table, and it's almost saying to you, take a look at this. This is going to be important later. You know? It's really sticking it in your face. On the stage, everything is a wide shot, and you get a close-up only by virtue of focusing the audience's attention on something, and you really get a sense of close-ups and wide shots and medium shots, depending on how the focus is laid on what's taking place. But because I think about this a lot, when I started writing movies, and I've written about 5 movies, I always approach them like plays because I came from the theater where...
And 4 Seasons is almost an entire cast of theater actors.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And there are visual things in it, plenty of visual things. But there's a tendency, I think, that's natural in filmmaking to lyrically tell you stuff visually that's not expressed through character and through endeavor, the character's endeavor to accomplish something.
Do you think that's because at heart movies are more dreamlike than theater?
Maybe they are. I don't know. But the fact that I've always wondered about the fact that you watch a movie in the dark on a big screen, and I've always wondered if, and this is really just highly speculative. I've never read any studies that even approach
it. We're from Marie Curie, so go ahead. Speculate.
The idea that you watch it on a big screen, and that is almost like a dreamlike experience. And I'm wondering if the same real estate in the brain that you dream with, is that being employed when you're watching a movie? The funny thing is, when you watch television, or at least in the old days when people watched television, it was on a much smaller screen and in a lit room. And there may be something about the difference in the two experiences that account for the fact that movie stars are so much more dreamlike figures for people than television stars are. Possibly it's not just that they watch the TV stars over and over and start to think that they know them as neighbors and friends. It might be the experience of seeing them. You can see a movie star 3 times in your life, and they have power over your dreams. Not so with TV people.
I think one of the things, though, and you must have seen this because you moved from television to movies, is that part of this TV is furniture. It's in your house. You often are not watching it and concentrating on it solely. The phone is ringing. The dog is around the house. The kids are there. Yeah. You go to a movie theater, you're making a kind of a surrender to
some
the environment.
People are.
Many people
are. A lot of people, the ones who sit behind me, talk.
Well, you can nowadays text them and tell them stop
talking.
That's
right. Yeah, that's an interesting point you bring up. Yeah, it is a commitment.
It is, and it's that same thing with the theater. You're going in and you're giving yourself to something. And one of the things, I guess, that fascinates me about you doing what you do is that way that you've got to use dialogue to score in the theater to get the audience's attention.
Yeah.
And I wonder
if
that's the thing that maybe appeals to you about that kind of writing. That
I love it. Again, and as I said, I grew up in it. So,
but you know, the thing, we're talking about power, and it really is about the power of the actor to use that dialogue to arrest the audience's attention.
Yeah. I mean, there have been attempts in the theater to get the audience's attention with scenery and floating chandeliers and helicopters and things like that in musicals. And in a way, that's trying to create a spectacle to take the place of the utter fascination that you can achieve with people on the stage with no scenery at all if they're really connecting brain to brain. There's nothing more arresting than that. And as exciting as many movies have been, for me, for my taste, they don't stand up to a really good play where the actors are toe-to-toe thinking at each other.
Well, I saw you in Glengarry Glen Ross, and I wondered if you're talking about repetitions, and that's one of the things that Mamet really does is that repetition. I wonder if working with Mamet's material, that changed the way you sort of underline, italicize these thoughts you had about repetitions, the way and some things
No,
work.
I had these thoughts before I ever heard of Mamet, but I do admire his dialogue. It's very interesting. It sometimes, when you try to learn it, the actor Bill Macy said, anybody who's tried to learn a Mamet play eventually wants to commit suicide. It's very hard to learn.
Because, is it? Why is it so hard?
The reason is that your character will start five sentences and not get past the first three or four words. And they all veer off in different directions. But eventually you realize that they're all heading toward some central idea. And you have to figure out why the person had these false starts and in order to get to the point that they were trying to make. And I've often thought that since I did the Glengarry play, I've often wondered if he didn't arrive at that through improvising himself, because it looks like the transcript of an improvisation. The brain is trying different ways to get to the point and discarding the ones that don't seem to work, the way we do in speech. And you don't know, you're not there at the moment of creation. You don't know why that character's brain is trying all those false starts. So you have to reconstruct it somehow.
And you know,
I had this very interesting experience. I was rehearsing Glengarry and I couldn't sleep. So I turned on television. I was disturbed. I couldn't figure out how to say the dialogue and make it sound like a person. And I saw an old Abbott and Costello movie, and they were doing one of the old routines, one of the routines I had seen when I was a kid, 2 or 3 years old, watching From the Wings. And I heard the rhythms of this burlesque routine, and I said, oh, my God, that's Mamet's rhythm.
Wow.
Isn't that interesting? And that made it much easier for me to hook onto it.
I think we have a record. The first person who ever to connect Abbott and Costello and David Mamet is my guest, Alan Alda. His new play, The Given Playhouse, is Radiance, The Passion of Marie Curie. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment, which you can also hear at kcrw.com. I happen to see you in the film adaptation of Pearly Victorious, Gone Are the Days. Mm. So you got to work with two of my favorite actresses, with Ruby Dee and with Diana Sands in the Owl and the Pussycat.
On the stage.
And it's probably one of the first plays ever to have an interracial relationship in which race was not mentioned.
Yeah. And it wasn't mentioned because it wasn't written for a black woman.
But it wasn't changed, though.
Not a word. And nobody said, well, now that it's a black woman, of course, we have to say this and this and that. And no, it was just she was this person.
How do people react to that when they finally sank in that there was no mention of race? Did you ever talk to people who said that was kind of a fascinating experience because it never came up?
There was one moment in the play where he humiliates her.
We're talking about the relationship basically between a constipated intellectual and a prostitute.
Yeah. He's hyper intellectual, not in touch with his own body, and she's
all body
and not in touch with her brain, and he tries to educate her. But at one point they have a fight and he humiliates her. And a lot of people found that, or some people found it offensive because he was humiliating a black woman. And it seems to me it would be offensive just to humiliate a woman.
Sure.
He wasn't presented as doing the right thing. He was wrong to do it in the play. But they had an extra feeling of dismay at that.
Sure.
But neither Diana nor I understood when we started doing it that people were going to think there was something funny about, something odd about a romance between these two people. We had worked together in an improvising company a year or two before, and we knew each other very well. And to us, we were trying to figure out how to play these two characters. And we both started to get hate mail. Not an awful lot, but, I mean, you know, a few pieces of hate mail where the people just couldn't take it. It's hard to go back in those times. That was only three or four or five years after they were burning churches in the South. It's difficult for us now to remember, now that we possibly have two black men running against each other for president.
But still, I mean, you think about how rare it is to see a kind of a racial mix in the play in terms of cast members where race is not an issue, even now.
Yeah,
I mean, we still
yeah.
have, maybe in some ways the world has changed a lot, but in plays it's very much not, it's not about that. And I only ask about that because I only came to be a fan of hers in films because I wasn't old enough to see her on the stage. But she was such a luminous actress.
She really was. She was. And didn't get the parts she should have got. She should have played Cleopatra. And she could have played a dozen other parts that she would be playing now. I mean, it was a fluke that she played a part. At the time, it was a fluke that she played a part that had been written with a white woman in mind. And the producer, Phil Rose, was smart enough and forward-thinking enough to realize it didn't have to be played by a white woman. He didn't have to change any words, that this is a person.
But getting back to passion again, so much of what you've done as a writer has been about finding a way to take things that mean something to you, oftentimes issues, and burying them in the subtext of drama. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's been something that's kind of been important to you, has it not?
Well, I don't try to make social points or anything. I try to understand human behavior. You know, like for instance, in my personal life, 25 or 30 years ago, I campaigned for the Equal Rights Amendment, and have often identified myself as a feminist. But I'm not trying to write a feminist tract.
That's what I'm saying. Do you bury it in terms of drama?
I don't even bury it. I just understand things a little differently. I mean, but I don't think there's anybody alive today who will see this play and not recognize the misogyny in the way Marie Curie was treated. But as a writer, I don't want to set up any straw dogs. When people behave badly toward her as a woman, I'm almost always using the actual words they spoke at the time. So I'm not trying to make set up a straw dog so that I can make the point. And I'm not trying to make the point. I'm just trying to understand what this person's obstacles were and make them real and believable so that you have a play that you can watch with mounting interest.
We're out of time. Alan, thank you so much for doing this.
I really enjoyed talking with you. Thank you.
Oh, my pleasure. My guest is Alan Alda. His new play is, which he's written, is Radiance, The Passion of Marie Curie. I just love saying the title, which is at the Geffen Playhouse. A recording engineer at KCRW in Santa Monica, who also edits and mixes the program, is J.C. Swadek. The associate producer is Jenny Radelet. Harry Ailes' producer. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
Find past episodes of The Treatment at kcrw.com or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Listen to The Treatment on demand on your smartphone with KCRW's apps. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.